name's Todd, and I'm going to facilitate this discussion, but not talk the whole time. Just want you to know. There's going to be lots of discussion between us, so be prepared to talk to your fellow Holdens. Is there a name, is there a term for Holdens? Is it like
Holdenites?
Holdenettes or Holdeners?
Holdenites.
Holdenites, yeah. Okay.
It's not Holdovers?
Holdovers.
Oh, I wish. I'll bring that up.
So Holdovers, Holdenites, that's who you're going to talk to today.
Holdenites.
So let's get started. Just a reminder, we are being recorded, so copious compliments towards me will be permanently archived here.
You're a wonderful person.
Yeah, thank you. And any negative comments saved for the evaluation program. Make it all lose. No, I am thrilled to be here. This is my first visit to Holden. I am an artist, an activist, and a teacher. Originally from North Carolina, so I do say you all, y'all, which means y'all, right, everybody. But I've also lived in New York for 4 years, so I'm currently living in Manhattan, helping manage a Quaker communal living house. It's a very, very tiny hole, and I'm taking back all kinds of ideas to make my home even more wonderful and much more like Holden.
Where is that?
It's off of Union Square, right in lower Manhattan. The Quakers have owned the house since 1897.
So I walked by it all those times and didn't know they were there?
Probably didn't. If you're on 15th and 3rd, exactly, is where the house is. But it's funny, Stuyvesant was the governor, the Dutch governor, and he had this large farm. He was anti-Jewish and anti-Quaker. And when he passed, his family eventually sold some of the property to the Quakers. So we're squatting on his land, and his statue is kind of grimacing over towards the Quaker meeting house in the park. Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
You have to join us in the circle.
Oh.
Please.
Okay.
Do you mind? Is that okay?
I'm not sure yet. Let me think about it.
Okay. You are totally welcome to come in the circle. A little bit. There'll be lots more about me in just a second. But so what are we doing here today? We're doing the first part, I hope, of a three-part gathering. I hope you'll come back on Tuesday and Friday. If you do not, I still love you and will talk to you in public. Okay? Don't run from me when you see me coming. I am a longtime teacher and don't mind the fact that maybe your story needs to pull you in a new direction after our initial time. That won't hurt you. But I do hope you'll come back because we're going to be building towards something. Now, what is that something? Hopefully by the end, you will have a beautiful work of art that is mostly black and white, but could have some color in it, that tells something about you and your journey, your life, and your connection to this place, or told through this place. In other words, can you find a reflection of who you are in this setting? I'll give you some examples as you go along to make that clear. But that should be the thing you're thinking about, right? That if I spend my time here, I'm going to leave with this deeper connection to Holden, something that I hope is beautiful, and can make a great gift when you go home, right? Or something to put on your wall and remember your time here. That's what we're working towards. Now, today, this component is called Let Your Life Speak. And what we're going to do is spend the first part of the class hearing some background on the work that I've done to give you some new stories to think about, new ways of using story and images. And the second half, you're actually going to be creating, journaling, and thinking about your story. Right? Stories that maybe you want to tell or grapple with. Does that make sense? So first section is listening, second section is talking, doing, thinking. Or maybe thinking the whole time. Does that sound fair? Alright. Now, as a little warm-up activity, I would like you to go over 11, I think I have plenty, and pick a picture that you could see yourself in some way, right? Maybe it's an experience here at Holden or some part of your life that this picture might reflect. This is a little warm-up activity. And then I want you to share that with a Holdenite and just tell them, the reason I picked this picture is, and what it says about me. Does that sound good? Go grab a picture and find a partner to speak to. Would anybody like to share something they've learned about their fellow Holdenite? Something in that conversation you go, yes.
I learned that Russ finally found out that Wisconsin and Iowa are not really the place to live. And he moved to Birch Bay, Washington.
Okay, all right. Anybody else? Something you learned about your fellow?
And I found out that Tim loves living in the West Coast and just especially in Washington. And so his picture was of a real Washington tree.
Yeah, I loved that tree. To me, that tree was about this idea of being alone, yet we now know trees interconnect their roots. Right? And so this lone wolf tree is actually part of a much larger organism.
I also tend to be tall.
And you're tall like a tree, good. Yeah. Anybody else have something they'd like to share? Anyone? Yes.
Julia is a geology major. Did geology minor, so she chose rocks.
Okay.
And
perfect.
She has been here a year at Holden, and so we're gonna talk some about that experience. And
anyone like to share something that you saw in the picture about yourself?
What? One thing. Yeah. Steve and I ended up on the same page, actually.
Picking the same picture?
No. Different pictures,
okay.
But we came up with similar interpretations. And basically, we were looking at our pictures and looking at how there are people who have come before us, we've looked up to these people, and how they've blazed a trail for us, and how, where they have made mistakes, some of them have been scary, they still have blazed the trail that we're following. And if they had not blazed that trail, where would we be now?
Right.
Did I get that right?
Yes, that works.
Wow. And you saw that both within your pictures.
Yes.
Can you share those pictures with the group?
Here's your chair. This is a fallen tree. It's an older tree that sort of paves the pathway for the rest of us.
Right.
And this is a picture of somebody, I think, laying on the ground, looking up at various trees, one of which looks kind of scary, which is the one with all the branches, one of which looks like it's ready to fall down, and the other one of which looks healthy and good, just like all the people you've looked up to. So,
in different aspects of the tree, right? Maybe failing health or...
Well, or failing different. Just in, they've let you down.
Okay.
Or you know, in all sorts of ways.
Right. Do you want to share anything else about these rocks? I mean, other than... Like, did you look at them and go, oh, these are 10 billion year old rocks from a volcano, or is there any other information in them?
Well, I immediately saw the rocks and decided to choose this photograph because of my geology background. And something that caught my eye is all of these photographs are in black and white, mm-hmm. So I'm not really able to pick out what these rocks are. I mean, I know, recognize some of them are probably schists from the way that they have waves, but it was interesting to me that because I don't have color, I can't discern what they are.
So you don't have the full information.
Yeah, and that's the way things are in life sometimes. You don't get full information,
yeah.
You know, like
excellent.
The classic thing, can't judge a book by its cover.
Right.
I thought about it a lot in my stay here at Holden ways too, so yeah.
Any thoughts on why these pictures are all black and white?
Because the color printers are very good.
That's a very pragmatic reason. Bad color printer.
Color printer isn't that good.
Can you think of another reason, though? Think about the title, Reformation of Personal Narrative. What does a black and white picture do?
Well, honestly, it made me curious because I thought initially it was a type of flower, but then I also thought it could be starfish.
Right.
And kind of loved the interplay of whether or not it was...
Right, one type of being or another. Right? So it adds some mystery, maybe. Black and white sometimes adds mystery.
For sure.
It's also a filter that changes the way we perceive something, right? You look at a flower, and it's beautiful, and you're noticing the red and so forth. When you take a black and white picture of it, all of a sudden you start noticing the shape of the leaf, right? The dark and light played by the light. And now your focus has been shifted. It's been reformed. And so I'm thinking that's also why we're working in black and white. It's also because the printer here is not great. The colored printer is not great. Hey, join us.
Sorry to be here.
No, glad you're here. We're just doing a warm-up exercise. So these pictures are all taken by me at Holden, and they will be part of the vocabulary that you can work with this week. If you are a photographer and you want help taking better pictures, or if you have photos that you've taken on a smartphone that you want to use, those can also be incorporated into your work this week. So we are working with photography and image making over the week. But I wanted to give you a beginning point, because I knew some of you might come in and go, oh gosh, I've got no great pictures. And I don't like to draw, right? So these are what these pictures are going to be used for. Let me collect those and we'll come back to them. I'll let you look through the list here. I'll let you look through them and see if you find a picture in there that speaks to you personally. You might see some of your story, and we'll come back later and get you to add in. All right, so I'd like to begin our time together after this warm-up with just a moment of silence and to introduce another aspect of my life, which is I'm a Quaker. And the best way to describe Quakerism is through the testaments that the Quakers try to live by: simplicity, peace, integrity, telling truth, being truthful, building community, equality, and stewardship. And I wasn't here long before I realized Lutherans at this place, and my experience with Quakers, are like going from one brother's house to another brother's house. I feel like we're brothers and sisters, because I think these also speak to this community, these core values. So I'd like to begin our time together with just a moment of silence. This can be used to center, to have you think about what you would like to get out of this time together, and then we'll come back together in just a moment. Did that moment of silence reform your attention? Did you notice something maybe before that you hadn't noticed? What jumps out? I hadn't noticed the clicking of the clock.
It was the clock.
Yeah. That clock was not present in this room until we got silent, was
right.
It? What else entered into this space? The walkie-talkie, right? We gotta make this place work, right? The machine that is holding behind, right? The experience that we have, that entered into this space. Did anything else reshape this space?
I immediately went to centering prayer.
Would you like to share that?
Oh, centering prayer?
Yes.
Oh, well, it's just...
Is it lengthy?
No, it's yeah. Just when if I do silence, which I practice silence, then you can just look behind the surface. If you close your eyes, think about it. And that's what it brings up for me.
Interesting. I'd like to know more about that centering prayer, silent prayer. Okay, good. I hope that was a moment just to exhale. I know some of you are coming up the mountain. I'm going to review quickly our time together for people that just walked in. We've done our welcoming activity. We're going to talk about the goals of the class in just a second more. And then I'm going to be sharing the work that I've been working over on for the last 20 years. It won't take 20 years to share. I'll move through it really quickly, and it's just a portion. But I want you to know my story and also have an opportunity to live a moment in the lives of all the people that I've worked with, because I've been very involved in a lot of very unique communities, and I would love to share that with you. I normally have people thank me for that experience, so I'm going to spend some time with that. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back. We're going to talk about good storytelling techniques, and we're going to do an activity together around that. Also, the 7 basic narratives that are used in storytelling. If you're not aware of these, they're a great tool for forming your own stories or to understanding other stories. And then we'll have some journaling time, where we're going to actually ask you to start writing a story down that you may want to use in your visual project. And then we'll do some sharing at the end, close with a moment of silence, and you'll have your homework, which is to flesh out that story that you started here today. I don't know about you, but if I have six eyes looking at me, I can't add 1 + 1, right? It really makes me nervous. So I'm hoping that you'll have an opportunity to take some time to write. The bookstore has these beautiful journals, if you don't mind writing on unlined paper. They may also have lined paper in the bookstore if you don't have something, but I also have paper here for our time together. Does that sound like a good time plan together? You know where we're headed? Good.
Could you share? So then you're doing another session tomorrow?
Yes, okay, right. I explained that earlier. There are three sessions. Okay. So the first session is thinking about story, about your own story, getting some tips on how to make your story stronger. Then this next class, we will actually be thinking about how to represent that visually. We'll go on a walk. We'll take some pictures. I'll gather pictures that you've maybe taken between now and then. And then we'll begin actually building a visual representation of that story. We'll finish that on Friday, and then we'll share it together on Friday. So it really is a three-part class. I hope people will stay to the end.
And can people come in tomorrow?
Yes, I'll catch people up.
Cool, thank
I'm
you.
A school teacher. I know how to catch students up on what they missed. All right, let me show you another video. Thank you. I work right here at a high school with inner city kids.
Is that on the Manhattan side?
Uh-huh. That's on the New York City side. Yeah, that's the Verizon building. This is the Brooklyn Bridge. Turn off at least the front part of these lights. Thank you. So my name's Todd Drake, and this is me in 1977. In North Carolina, it rarely snows, and you can see there's just a touch of snow on the ground, which is worthy of like not having to go to school. My mom has rushed out and bought, you know, plenty of bread and milk. And eggs, you know, all the things you got to have to survive a snowstorm. The store is always empty out. This is like an inch maybe of snow. And I'm standing in my new jacket that I received for Christmas. It's a down jacket. This is a new invention, and I'm so proud of it. And I'm in my backyard in Jamestown, North Carolina. What you may not know from looking at this picture is that my stepfather has just died. My father died before him. And my mother and I are just recovering from that loss. I lived with my mother in this home until I graduated from school in 1980 and took off to college. Rumi says that you have to keep breaking your heart until it opens. And this loss of my father was the first time that my heart was broken. Now, when my father died, I was one. And didn't know my dad. I have just a few memories of him. But it cast a shadow over our family. My mother remarried. But both my mother and my brother, older brother, were wounded, of course, by that loss. We were uprooted from our little tiny town in North Carolina and moved to New Jersey. And that deeply affected my brother's life. I'm going to tell you a few more things along that line. And I hope they're not triggering to anyone. That might be going through a current loss. If so, you can step outside for a few minutes and we'll get on with the story. This is my father, the only picture I have with my dad in 1963-62. He was dead within a year. This is my stepfather. My mother had been in love with him in high school prior to dating my dad, but he was the bad boy of the high school. He played pool and he ran off to listen to music. And so my grandfather, who was a principal, said, Elizabeth, this is a bad guy. You're not going to marry him. You're not going to see him. Well, after the death of my stepfather came back into the picture. This is my mother, and in 2009 she passed. Soon after that picture was taken in 1977, my mother developed a brain tumor and suffered from it for the next 30 years until her death. And I was her primary caretaker. an advocate during those times. Now, who raised me after the loss of my father was Troop 68. They say that it takes about 12 men to help a boy become a man. And I had those 12 men in this scouting group. And this is an old van of one of our scoutmasters in a scout camp that no longer exists. But they were good to me, and they taught me how to be a good man. As my son says, the least toxic male he's ever met. White male. In 1990, my wife and I moved into a new home. We were just married. And six Montagnard men moved next door. And this is where I first came into contact with Lutherans. Lutheran Church of the Resurrection, sponsored these six men. And I saw these white people coming over there with food and taking these guys out. And I was like, what's going on? And I found out that there was this compassionate and liberal-leaning Christian group called Lutherans, and I was enamored with them. And together we became very active in Lutheran Family Services. And for 20 years, I was a member of the Lutheran Church. These gentlemen grew up and went off on their own way, but Hob was particularly close to us. He fell in love with this young woman, and I remember thinking that she was too pretty for him and that she probably wouldn't be a good wife. And she had a sister who wasn't quite as attractive, and I said, Yi-Chen, maybe you should date the other girl. And he's like, okay, thank you, Todd, and he didn't. Later, we found out that the other girl was like a criminal, was in trouble with the law. He did the best job picking the best bride. And Han Yi-Chen had children that my family named, because that's their custom. The oldest woman in the family named them, so my mother got to pick their names. And Lutheran Family Services shaped my whole family along with my son. So I am now an adult. I'm getting over those heartbreaks, and I'm finding a path for myself. And I develop this trinity of activities, art making, art teaching, and activism. And they have served me well up until this very moment. They are what feed each other and feed me, both in body and spirit. I want to talk to you briefly about some of the communities I've worked with. I received a Rockefeller Fellowship in the early 2000s, and I made art with all kinds of people across North Carolina, and that led me to be concerned about two groups, the undocumented and Muslim Americans. I saw them as our most vulnerable citizens, and so I started doing deeper projects with them. Those projects led me to places like Bahrain with the State Department, also Saudi Arabia. This is me teaching Saudi women how to do self-portraits, right? Look at their faces. This is me in a Saudi Bedouin tent speaking to a gentleman. It also took me to Israel and Palestine with the State Department, along with to Turkey. Today I'm working with inner city kids in New York City, and prior to that I was in North Carolina working with rural kids. I've also taught historically black universities. So how did I end up there? I'll show you some of the work that took me down these paths. But first I want to tell you that the narratives that we take in shape our actions, right? We learn most easily from images and story. And I want to tell you the importance of like carefully considering story and image. And these are two examples. This photo was taken by the family of Miss Conyer. This photo was taken by my family. And what links them is that these are both domestics. In the early 1900s in the South, it was common to hire people of color to do your laundry, to do your cooking, to do the hard work. And this is my mom at age 16, sitting at the foot of a sophronia. And this is a picture that my family took from their perspective. This is Miss Conyer. Miss Conyer is the grandmother of a close friend of mine. And I asked her for a photo because I heard that her mother was a domestic. And this is what she gave me. And I said, Sonia, do you have a picture of her, you know, working? And she said, Todd, we didn't value that job, right? That job was the only thing we could get. We're not going to go and take pictures of ourselves, you know, working for the for a white family. This is her graduating in her 50s from college after a life working as a domestic. She said, this is what we're proud of. And so I offer these two pictures because as I show you this work, I am an outsider taking pictures looking in, but I'm trying to make sure that I'm paying attention to what the community cares about. And I think this is an important part of story creation, right, is to think about the perspective. Bayard Rustin, a famous Quaker, welcome. Thank you for coming. Bayard Rustin, a famous, well, not famous, actually, Quaker. He's not famous because he was gay and had for a short time been associated with the Communist Party early in the 1900s. But he was the one behind the March on Washington where Martin Luther King made his famous I Have a Dream speech. Because of Bayard Rustin's work, that speech happened. And also, you know, the nonviolent angle that the civil rights protesters took? That came from Bayard, and his background is a Quaker. He says, we are never called to view the world through only one lens. And so the work that I'm going to show you is looking at different worlds through different lenses, and I hope you enjoy that. What are you looking at right here? This is a photo taken of an undocumented man. He's a yard worker. He makes his living weed eating. And so I'm taking a photo of him obscuring his face because he's undocumented and I don't want to have him arrested because of my photo. He is also very sad. His son had the year before committed suicide. His son was undocumented and I was involved in helping the family right after the death of their son, so I knew about his story. He looked at this photo and I said, are you okay with me using this and telling your story? He said, yeah. He said, I want you to know this though. Someday I hope my eyes look as bright as my daughter's, the young daughter that had lived. And I'll tell you the rest of the story in a little bit. The first project I'm going to talk to you about in depth is the Essequam Badiri Project, and this is a Muslim American self-portrait. Now, I was afraid in the early 1900s that Muslim Americans would be railroaded into concentration camps the way the Japanese Americans were. And we came close to that happening. But I went out into the community. I didn't know any Muslims. I just looked up mosque or masjid on the internet and found some buildings and started going, literally knocking on the door. I didn't know when their holy day was, on a Friday or anything. So I started making connections. And this gentleman in behind this portrait, named Tamir, was my go-between. He helped me find people. And then finally he said, Drake, I want you to take my portrait. I was like, okay, Tamir, great. I'm so glad you're going to participate. Tamir, what do you want to do in your portrait? He said, I want you to take a picture of me in a Superman shirt. Now, this is about 2004, right? So I'm like, yee, how is this going to fly? I said, Tamir, why do you want to wear a Superman shirt? He said, because when I was a kid, I was filled with hatred. I was caught up in a racist environment in Florida, had been treated badly, and I had nothing but hate for anybody that didn't look like me. And he said, my religion has freed me of that, and today I feel like a Superman. I feel like I can love all, and I'm trying to serve all people. I was like, okay, great. Tamir, where's your t-shirt? Superman t-shirt. He said, I don't have one. So I had to buy one on the internet, go with this big man out into a cornfield because he grew up on a cornfield, and I'm laying in 90-degree August heat, yeah. Looking up this big black man, burying his chest at me, taking a picture, and I'm thinking, the places I go for my art. But it's one of my favorite images, and Tamir has stayed in touch. He works in prisons trying to help diffuse radicalism. This is Halona. She was a Muslim living in my community who was chased out of the community college. Anytime she would come in and sit down, people would get up and move away from her. They slashed her tires. They would say terrible things behind her back. And this community college couldn't stop it, so she had to drop out of school. When I went to the school to say, could we come in and take a picture of this, they were like, no way. So I went to another college, a Quaker college. I thought, oh, they'll be behind this. And they said, no, no way. People will think it happened here. So I had to find this old desk, and I took her out in a field with a white sheet and made this portrait. At the time, many years after, several years after, she was trying to complete her college degree through online courses. When people have seen this in exhibitions, they've said, this is terrible, this shouldn't be happening in other countries. And then they catch that it happened in North Carolina. This is the Carolina Cyclones girls basketball team. And when I took this to Saudi Arabia, men who had studied here came up and said, I know those ladies. I went to school with them at UNC Charlotte. It's just a beautiful kind of turning on your head picture of what Muslim women are often portrayed as. This is Ola. She wanted her portrait to portray the moon and nature. So I created this collaboratively with her. I thought the moon.
Oh, that's beautiful.
The moon completed her face.
Yes.
Made it into
yes.
a full face. Ola went on to be an AmeriCorps volunteer teacher in the schools. This is Marty's portrait. He has read the Torah, which is the Old Testament, the Bible, and the Quran. And he wanted to be photographed showing that with this coexist above. And this is his family helping me hold this, these three up. This is his wife, himself, and his son all holding those up because he couldn't hold all three for the portrait. This is Nushmia. She was torn between her American pop culture upbringing and her Afghani traditions that her family brought to this country. Later, she expressed regret because she held my son's hand for this portrait, which is inappropriate, you know, in her parents' culture, not in her American culture. But Nushmi has gone on to do great things. She was working for Google the last time I spoke with her. This is Eric. Eric is a white convert to Islam. And he lost his child because he became Muslim. His family thought he was going to be a terrorist, so they took him away. And this is him praying in the back of a pizzeria. I used several photos and then photoshopped them together. This is Muhammad. Muhammad was difficult to work with. He was a pizzeria owner, and he kept talking about politics, and I didn't care anything about that. I didn't want to portray that. When sitting in his pizzeria, a homeless man came in and received a lunch, actually this lunch, and sat down. And I said something to him about that. He said, I've been feeding the homeless for the last 10 years. He said, I've discovered them eating the pizza out of my dumpster. And I said, you're a human, come in. And to this day, he still feeds the homeless without charge. Soda drink and a slice of pizza. The homeless. He said, don't show my face. My wife doesn't like the fact that I do this. So he turned around for the picture. So that series got the attention of a new museum opening at Heart Mountain where they interred the Japanese, many families, thousands of people during World War II. This is Heart Mountain, and this is a photo of that field that you see right here. I took this photo I visited. This is a reconstruction of the tower. This is a tower built to keep U.S. citizens behind that fence. Think about that. I was honored to be exhibited there for the first time. They wanted to draw a connection between the Muslim experience today and what happened to the Japanese American. And that caused a stink. It was all over the internet. People were writing letters, coming in, being angry. The community was able to accept the history, right, that perspective, but they didn't want to really deeply think about what was happening to the Muslim American, right? That was just the enemy, regardless of the situation, and that was the very thing that this community center tried to address. The U.S. State Department and the UN heard about that series and invited me to come to Bahrain, and this is me. If you ever seen me doing this, you know I'm nervous because this is the King of Bahrain's son-in-law sent to inspect the exhibition that I put together, and this is the ambassador. So the ambassador for the U.S. shows up. They're trying to do a very special project to educate the Bahraini government, and this is the Bahraini representative, and I'm explaining the work. Can you imagine why I'm a little upset, a little nervous? It went very well, though. This is some of the work and the people that I worked with in Bahrain. Now, I want you to remember that in Bahrain, the citizens have no right to free speech. the king can jail anybody for anything. And this young man took this portrait of himself laying on this arrow, and when the king's son-in-law came to it, he said, "What is this?" Now, the Arab Spring was going on. There were riots in the streets. There were tanks. And he said, "This is how I feel because I have no job and no direction." And the king's son-in-law said, "What's your name?" Had his assistant write it down. He said, "We'll find you a job." And the last time I talked to him, he was working in a shoe company. He found a job. I don't know if it was life direction. This woman is talking about the horror of what she's seen happening in her country. And when the king, this is her, when the king's representative came, she stood up and told him how she felt. "I'm a longtime Bahraini. I'm scared of what's happening to our country." And again, with no right. The State Department was trying to make an example of like diversity and acceptance of me, right? I'm a white, non-Muslim American making all this art with Muslims being friendly, and they brought me over. And together we created these works and displayed both the American work and the Bahraini work. This is some of the work. This is how this young man was feeling during the Arab uprising. This is how this student felt. Remember, they have no freedom of speech. Trust is like a paper. Once it's crumbled, it's never perfect again. This woman didn't want to talk about politics. She wanted to talk about the fact that she loved to cook. So there's a Muslim covering her head with a cooking pot. And this is the story the king had printed about the show. I was very hopeful, and I went back several years later to do another workshop, only to find out that the king was imprisoning 16-year-old photographers and torturing them. And this photo by a young man named Ahmed caused him to be jailed. This is protest writing that the king had painted over in 2014, so I've not elected to go back. The undocumented community is another group I've worked with. This is the wife of the man I just showed you. She's holding flowers for the young man that's committed suicide. She didn't bury him. She had him cremated because she didn't know where they were going to be allowed to live. Now, they're undocumented. They came here because they had been robbed twice in Mexico and felt unsafe. They come to America, they start a new life, and their son commits suicide. I want to tell you how the story ends, though. Before the son killed himself, he had helped the police break up a drug ring in school. And a lawyer heard about that and got a visa for everybody in the family, and now the family's leaving. From the grave, he saved his family and gave them a new home. So today he's buried in the United States, and the family is all here legally. This is Liz. She was in a military school, high school in South Carolina, had a full ride to college. When they discovered she was undocumented, they took away all the money, and she was going to one class, paying for it herself. She's wearing her old school uniform, saluting in her shadow, and crying as she's standing there. I don't know what happened to Liz. This family was undocumented. The mother was undocumented. The children are citizens, so I hid the mother's face and altered the children's face slightly so that the family couldn't be traced. This young man was deported. He walked back, and I think was deported again and came back again. He said, "My roots are here. I've grown up here." So he buried his feet in the dirt to show his connection to North Carolina. This young woman is undocumented from California. Her mother has to work two shifts at McDonald's to pay all the bills. Notice what the bag says. "My special moment." When I pointed that out to her, she said, "I have no special moments with my mother. I don't get to see her." I don't have the internet to show you this, but if you want to hear the story of a dreamer who was done wrong by her husband and the police in North Carolina, just Google "dreamer" on YouTube and Todd Drake, and this is still up. Be prepared for an emotional ride because she holds back no punches and she tells you exactly what happened to her, and it is riveting. this gentleman was separated from his son because of undocumented immigration. He worked in New York in the snow, upstate New York, rode his bike in the snow to work until many, I think 10 years later, he's reunited with his son. And I have the calendar here, and I've altered the lower portion of his face so that you can't identify him. He's still undocumented. His son's still undocumented. They're at risk now of being deported by this recent push. So the activism part of me led me to work with Faith Action, and I created materials for them. I helped start an ID program that has given an ID to anyone that needs one, including the undocumented, so that they can register their children in school, so that the police don't have to spend 3 hours over a traffic stop determining who they are. And I'm happy about that. That's the ID. It's probably up more like 120,000 now. The State Department took me to Palestine, and this is a photo I took of Palestinian students that I thought represented their experience of trying to grow up and be normal in a very abnormal situation. These are Palestinian women crossing through checkpoints. From Jerusalem to Ramallah used to take like a half an hour. Now it takes like 3 to 5 hours because of the checkpoints. This was my taxi driver, and he told me the story about how the city officials that run Jerusalem, the Jewish city officials, had turned his family's graveyard, which had been there for hundreds of years, into a park, which meant he was going to lose his family ancestral burial ground. And he said, "Todd, I have no place to live and no place to die." This is the valley. What's it called where Christ is predicted to return? Right outside of Jerusalem? I forgot the name of it. These are all Jewish graves over here. And there's some Christian graveyards there as well.
It's not the Kidron, is it?
The Kidron?
Kidron Bell.
It's such a famous name, yeah. It'll come to us, but it's just outside the walls. The wall of Jerusalem is right behind my back taking this picture. This is Silwan, which is a small community, and the Jewish government is coming in and bulldozing Palestinian homes. And so this is a home that's been bulldozed. He took me to see, and there's a lot of protest over that, because while the Israelis say the houses are undocumented and illegal, the UN and other people say that the demolishing is illegal. This is a Palestinian standing in his beautiful wheat field. This is a wall that they've pushed up. This is the dividing wall that the Jewish government built, Israelis built, to separate sections of Bethlehem from Jerusalem. And the Palestinians have pushed a dumpster up and lit it. And you can see the fire and the anger that they feel over that wall. These are school children coming home out the east gate, which is very important to the Palestinians. And I was up on the wall looking down at them. I loved the interaction between the school children and the old guy carrying the stuff. This kind of sums up the situation in Israel, doesn't it? This is a Palestinian baby, maybe a Jewish baby, I don't know. But look what he's been given as a toy, play gun. This is the Wailing Wall. I was allowed to go up to it and slip a little prayer. I was told that the prayer wall that's so important to the Jewish community was a direct conduit to God. So those are all prayers directly delivered to God. This is the scene of a crime I witnessed in Palestine, in the West Bank. Jewish settlers that are trying to take land stand by the side of the road, and if a Palestinian car pulls up, they walk up and say, "Give me your prayer shawl, give me your Quran, whatever." They ask. If you don't, they stone the car. And this was happening as we pulled up, and I just took a quick picture, came out black, but in Photoshop I was able to recover the image because I was on manual and didn't have it set up. This is a young student work that I work with students to create pictures, so these are a few of their works. This young man has trouble with his ID. He has an ID, but he doesn't look like his ID. He looks older, so he gets picked on by the the Israeli police. Beautiful picture of the dome on the rock. This is Rana. She's now a doctor in Germany. This is a Palestinian school teacher. And I created a video working with the Palestinian kids, but I can't show that to you. This is the work that I brought back from Israel in Palestine. And I'll go through this real quickly because I want to give us a break, and then we'll move into our second hour. I was invited to go to Turkey and Syria, and this is a Syrian refugee. I have no idea where he is. He could be dead. He could have been enslaved, or he could be in a school in Germany, you know, ready to graduate. This is a food line. Syrians just fleeing into Turkey, getting their one meal of the day. This young girl is hungry. I'm back behind the food line kitchen looking out. And these are North Carolina youths I worked with. I'll just move through these quickly. These are all at-risk youth. This young man is undocumented and wants to be free of the stereotypes he's trapped in. She grew up on land that were given to her family after they were freed from slavery, but it's become a white, rich neighborhood, and she feels like a stranger. Some projects I did with Muslims and inner city youth. Silence is a language down south. This man was gay and ostracized by his family. He became a hoarder. She was abused as a child. This couple, gay and can't go home. That's their home in the background of the woman on the right. And this is a project I did around my father. And his he was building trailers when he died. That's a current one. So grief can be a garden of compassion. If you keep your heart open through everything, your pain can become your greatest ally in your life's search for love and wisdom. This is by Rumi, and it's been one of the guiding things that have brought me to where I am today. I'm not that lonely boy that just lost his dad at 17. I'm now a member of a beautiful family. These are my sons and their family members. And my work is at equalist.com if you're interested in seeing other work. I'm also a painter. All right, that's a lot to throw at you. I want to give you just a minute to depressurize, use the bathroom, and we're going to move into activities. Is that good?
Great.
I hope you'll stay around. And if you have any questions, you can talk to me in person.